The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'll call to order State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. The first bill on the agenda is House File 817. Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, the motion to your bill, is this to the General Register?
To Finance.
Representative Kahn?
To Finance.
To Finance. So, Representative Kahn, why don't you make your motion?
Yes, I would move that House File 817 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. And Representative Kahn, do you need to put the A1 amendment on at this time?
Yes.
So, Representative Kahn, you're moving the A1 amendment?
Yes, I would move the A1 amendment.
And what does the amendment do?
Let me have all factual questions answered by the person who will do a better job.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. The author's amendment addresses concerns raised by the private colleges as well as MINSU and the University of Minnesota related to the student list. So it makes providing student lists for election day registration under the process outlined in the bill optional for private colleges. It continues to make it mandatory for MINSU, which they're fine with, but allows them to have the chancellor turn in all of the numbers. It deletes the requirement to send the student identification number and clarifies that the other information is sent as permitted by applicable privacy laws. The other two things that this does is it sets an effective date for the online voter registration, that it's only effective after we have done the programming and tested it. And it deletes the final section of the bill related to checking the status of an absentee ballot.
All right. So, Ms. Fraser, we have all of higher education then is amenable to these changes with the student information?
Mr. Chair, that's my belief.
Your belief, or do we need to bring them up?
Mr. Chair, that's what I've been told by the representative.
All right. Any further discussion to the A1 amendment? All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kahn, to your bill as amended.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, this bill does the following two things. It makes it easier for college students to vote where they go to school, and it also creates an online voter registration verification system. But the changes to the statewide voter registration system would not go into effect until the stability and security of the statewide voter registration has been tested and certified. And again, this was an issue in my district in the last election, where the lists that were sent from the dorms were just fine, but there was problems with some of the large buildings very close to the campus, which were almost entirely inhabited by students. And one of the in one of the precincts, that the problem is that the state law identification law, which accepts the utility bill, and in some of these big complexes, the utilities are included in their rent statement. So they kind of need a statement from the manager of the building stating that. And there was in one large building in one precinct, it took three shots before they got a statement that was acceptable to the current election judge, even though the same statement had been accepted in previous elections. Anyway, let me ask again Ms. Fraser to go through the details of the bill and why it's missing.
Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, as Representative Kahn said, the bill does two or three basic things. It does make it easier for students to vote and easier for election administrators to allow students to vote. For decades, colleges have been allowed to provide lists of students who live on campus or within a 10-mile radius of campus. And then students can come into the polling place and do election day registration using their student ID card in combination with the list. Some jurisdictions have worked with the colleges to provide the list of students that live within 10 miles of the campus, but what they found is that it's very cumbersome in that they don't have a way to precinct the list. So they need to make a copy of the entire list and provide it to every precinct within the 10-mile radius, which is a lot of extra paper. It's cumbersome for the election judges, having a lot of information that they don't need in that precinct. So we're suggesting a process that will allow the information to be more streamlined. It would come to our office, we would precinct it, sort it, send it to the counties, and then they could print the information just for that precinct and send it to the right precinct, making it easier for election administrators, election judges, and students. The two other things the bill does is it provides for online voter registration for individuals who have a driver's license or state ID card. This is the same model that's been used in Arizona and the state of Washington very successfully. I believe that there is a frequently asked questions document in your packets from the state of Washington about online voter registration. I would note that in both of those cases, those programs were implemented under Republican secretaries of state, and they found that it significantly reduces costs related to data entry because people are going online, updating their registration. And just like other institutions, for example, I was called for jury duty a few weeks ago and was able to go online and fill out the form and swear under penalty of perjury online that the information I was submitting was true. So if the courts can do it, it seemed that we could do it for voter registration as well. It makes some conforming changes, and then the final thing the bill does is it provides for online confirmation of registration, which many other states provide, and at this point we do not. So it would allow a voter to go onto our website to put in their name, their address, and their date of birth, and to find out, are they currently registered at that address or not. It will significantly reduce phone calls to counties, as well as reduce duplicate forms from people that are sending in another form just in case, for some reason, they're no longer registered.
There's been kind of one other person that wants to testify. Ryan Anderson, MSUSA, why don't you come back? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Ryan Anderson. I'm the student body president at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Okay, and I also work with the Minnesota State University Student Association. We work together with the seven state universities to represent over 70,000 students, and we work a lot on issues of college affordability, but also issues of civic engagement. And over the last several months, MSUSA has worked with students across the state to engage their peers in non-partisan voter registration, voter education, and get out the vote efforts. Today I'm here to speak in favor of House File 817. First, residential housing lists have been very helpful for students living in the dorms. Students often have a hard time producing the sorts of documents they need to prove their residence, and election day registration is easier when students can show their student ID to be matched to a list of addresses that the school provides. When I was talking to students on election day this year, many people had questions about how to register to vote if they weren't already registered. Some students had a utility bill in their name or a friend to vouch for them, but unfortunately there were some students, though eligible to vote, who could not vote because they did not have the documents they needed to prove where they live. It was disappointing to see students excited about voting turned away, and I wonder how many of them will be back for the next election or how many will now be turned off from voting. Expanding the residential housing list to include off-campus students will help ensure that eligible voters will be able to cast their ballot. Students also support the provisions to allow online voter registration and a way to check online if an individual is registered to vote. Students are accustomed to doing any number of things online, from paying their tuition bills, registering for classes, buying textbooks, and communicating with their professors, friends, and family. In an increasingly digital world, it seems only appropriate that these functions are available for voting. During the course of our voter registration drive, we heard from a number of students not sure if they were registered to vote at their current address. The best answer we could give them is to go ahead and register again, just to be sure. Will this probably cause more administrative work if they were already in fact registered? It is the best solution we could provide. In the future, it would be great to have a resource for us to check for ourselves and help our peers make sure that they're registered or prepared to register on Election Day. So thank you so much for your time, and I believe a letter has been circulated on behalf of several members of the Voting Rights Coalition who I'm representing today.
All right. Any questions? No. Representative Plante.
Mr. Chairman, I will defer until we're having the discussion going.
All right. Anyone have any questions for Mr. Anderson? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill as amended? All right, seeing none, then members' questions, Representative Plante.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in regards to the residential housing list section, I have several concerns about this. And one of them is that it doesn't seem as though you're going to be filtering this list from the student housing. I know there are foreign exchange students that also attend college in several of our universities. There are non-citizen students that are attending our colleges. Also, these same students are often maybe registered to vote in other states. They're attending from other states, many of them. And they are registered to vote in other states or in other parts of Minnesota. So the question I have is, how are you planning to deal with this residential housing list in regard to these issues?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, all of the concerns that you're raising would seem to be just as true of the current residential housing list, which already allows for lists of students that live on campus or within 10 miles of campus. So I don't think those concerns are related to the bill as it stands. They seem to be related to the current law. And everyone that registers needs to certify under penalty of perjury that they are a U.S. citizen, that they are 18, that they are eligible to vote, and that they are not voting elsewhere.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Fraser, but you're doing this electronically, and you're taking a step of precincting them and doing other steps along the way. I know that another bill you have is having driver's license, working with EPS. I mean, the nice thing about this is we're not just replacing paper with something electronic. You're taking a step here to precinct them and do other things. I mean, it seems like, my gosh, as long as you got it, why would you not want to make this better and just simply replace paper with another kind of paper? Because that's all you're really doing here then is precincting it and sending it back out in paper to the counties. Why not take that extra step when you have electronic? I mean, that's what technology does. It makes it possible to do it better. Isn't this what this is about, is doing things also better?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, it is about doing things better, and we believe that this is an improvement. It will save costs at the local level and make it easier for eligible students to register. I'm not sure if you're offering an amendment. I'm not sure what improvement you're suggesting.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I just would like you to explain, why would you not want to include those kinds of things that we do for any other voter while we are at it. I mean, we don't put people on lists. I appreciate what you're attempting to do here, but I think you're really missing an opportunity, and the chairman doesn't like amendments in writing and some of these things, and
no,
obviously...
Representative Kiffmeyer, I do like amendments
better.
In writing. It's the oral amendments that have caused some problems with this on occasion, so... If you are offering one, we'll do the best with staff to make sure it's in writing so everyone understands.
I'll work on that, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Fraser, I forget. I think it was you that testified that the student would have to present their student ID. The question I've got is, under this proposal, couldn't a student register online and then show up at the precinct the day of the election and just identify him or herself, be identified by the election judge on the voter registration roll, and then vote?
Representative Fraser. Ms. Fraser, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. That is possible that they would be caught and charged with a felony if they tried to vote twice.
I didn't ask.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't understand the question.
Representative Emmer.
I was just trying to understand.
I think I can answer.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
I think I understand. You're saying that someone could pre-register and then could just, and then would be on the list. Yes, that's completely true. It's often hard to do the pre-registration drive on campus, and this is just for the same day registration and voting.
Representative Emmer.
Well, then how do we make sure that we maintain our the security of the system, the integrity of the system? Because how are you going to be able to verify somebody who's out in space on the Internet providing personal information, apparently, but we don't know where that information comes from, and then they show up at the precinct and identify themselves only by a name on a list?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we are limiting online voter registration to those who have a Minnesota driver's license or state ID number. So they would enter the information. It would then be verified against the driver's license and state ID information. If there was a mismatch, if there was not somebody with that name, driver's license number, and date of birth, they would not be registered.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Dutwalt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Ms. Frazier, you know, we hear a lot about ID theft. There's a lot of it that's going on these days, people stealing identification, whether it's a checkbook or a credit card, other identification, somebody gets someone's wallet. And I can imagine, and believe me, nobody's given me any notes on this. This is something I've thought about with this bill. So now I've got your ID. I know what your number is. I go online and I register as you. We know that some of this information is often marketed. They literally sell identification for the people whose identities they've stolen. What is there to prevent that sort of fraud from happening, where somebody can register as somebody else?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I appreciate the question, but I don't think that it's any different than if you stole my wallet, you could fill out a voter registration form that calls for a driver's license or the last for my SSN. You could fill it out and sign it. It's the same thing. You could go online and type it in, or you could fill out a card and mail it in.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Somehow when you look at the voters for identity theft, I think a false vote is probably on the lowest list of reasons why people do identity theft.
Representative
Gobo. Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, regardless of whether it's low on the totem pole, it is one of the possibilities, and integrity is what we're after. What Ms. Frazier said is technically true, but the possibility is that somebody could steal identity, register in a different precinct under a different name, and use this as a means of filing a false vote. It could be done, and maybe it could be done under the current system as well, but then that's still a concern.
Mr. Chair, I think you're looking at three felonies that you just listed.
Yes, well.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Connor, Ms. Frazier, I mean, the more I'm thinking about it, the driver's license, you go and use that or state ID card, don't you have to have access to DPS or some other databases to verify? And then how would the number, a driver's license number won't allow you to cross-reference to county of residence or any other county, or will it? I mean, how are you going to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, since 2004, because of the Help America Vote Act, every new registrant or every person re-registering is cross-referenced, is verified against the driver's license and state ID database if they have a driver's license or state ID number. If they instead give us the last 4 digits of a Social Security number and they don't have a driver's license or state ID number, then they're verified against the Social Security Administration database. So we do have access to that database.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, you have access to it, but all it tells you is that number exists. Somebody has it. I mean, how do you use that number to check that there are not multiple registrations so somebody doesn't make a mistake?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, they are verified against full name, date of birth, and driver's license number. Because driver's licenses are there and for everyone that's registered since 04, and full name and date of birth is there for everyone that's registered since 1983, it's possible and to pull up the person's record, the exact record. And so there's not more than one record for an individual in the system, because they're able to find Tom or Thomas Emmer with a certain birth date with a certain driver's license number. So you have one record in the system. When you re-register, we verify it against the driver's license database, and then we verify your address by sending you a non-forwardable postcard, and if it's returned, then there's a challenge placed on your record.
Right, Mr. Chair. I don't want to get into the mailings, because I think that brings up a different issue, but I'm talking about, you can certainly pull up a record, but are you telling me that over the past couple of years, or let's just say in the last election, your office accessed the database, pulled up actual records, verified that a certain driver's license number that was attached to a certain individual who had moved was now registered in a different county, and then your office went back to the original county or precinct and made sure that the other registration that might still be on the roll was deleted.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Representative, it's a statewide database. So when I moved from St. Paul to Minneapolis, Hennepin County pulled up my record out of the statewide database that was a Ramsey County record. They input my Minneapolis address. They verified it against the driver's license database. And we have a system where if there's an exact match with name, date of birth, and driver's license number, it's automatically verified. If there's not an exact match, then the county auditor looks at each record one by one and looks at possible matches. Is it Beth, Elizabeth? Are there two digits reversed? If they can determine that it is the same person, then the record is verified. If it's not, then it's not verified.
I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't think you answered my question. I'm asking if based on this verification process, you're telling us that before the last election, there were actually verifications that advised a different county that might have an earlier registration to delete that or clean that off their roll.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
I see the secretary nodding. So.
Mr. Frazier.
Yes, Representative. That's not exactly how it works, but yes.
Okay.
All right. Any further discussion to the bill as amended? All right, then we have some amendments. Representative Emmer, I think you have several amendments. No, you don't. Not to this bill. Are you going to offer any amendments?
We have amendments.
That's what I'm saying. You want to offer them now?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Would you like to offer them at this point? Or?
Which one do you have?
I have the A4 amendment. No. I don't know if you're offering the A4 or who's offering it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair would like to offer the A4 amendment. I'm hoping that the third time is the charm here, and that we do instill voter identification cards and make it mandatory to prove your identity when you do go to vote. We heard testimony today that students are having a hard time gathering the correct documents, that students could not vote because they did not have the documents they needed to vote. But the bill does say that a student can show a student identification card or a driver's license, especially if we're moving in the online voting system. I think that that's something we should require, is that if they're registering online to vote, that they should be able to prove who they are when they go to the polls with just simply a student ID card or a Minnesota driver's license or the Minnesota voter card. That can be obtained for free. And, if they are unable to do those things, they also can fill out a provisional ballot. So we feel like this is a good way in adding some additional integrity to the system and making sure that we have a foolproof system here when people show up to vote, that we know who they are and we can match votes to voters. And Mr. Chairman, I would request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Gutwall, to the Sanders Amendment.
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the amendment, this gets at the issue I was raising earlier. If you're going to go online and put your information in electronically, I think we're going to be doing more of that. That's great. But on the day of the election, making sure that the person who put that information in to register is also the person who is voting is vitally important to making sure the integrity of the process is there. This is the only way in my mind that you can make darn sure that it wasn't a stolen ID, it wasn't somebody who just registered and then sent somebody to vote on behalf of that person. You need to know that the person at the poll is the same one who registered online. And the only way to do that is to have them show some sort of ID. I think this is a very good amendment.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, I want to thank you. I don't know if I'm going to, well, if this goes on, I'll probably vote for the bill today, but I don't know that I'm going to because I still have to learn a little bit more about it. But I do want to thank you because you are getting us incredibly close to the photo ID requirement by setting up a system that's frankly based on exactly what this amendment would provide. I think we'll at some point redub it the Kahn Amendment, but we'll wait until we get there. And I thank you for getting us so close.
Representative Kahn, to the Sanders Amendment,
yes,
is the author
Sanders
of the
Amendment dramatically expands besides the fact that we voted it down two times, but it dramatically expands the scope of the bill. The bill is only dealing with student voting, and I do think that we should keep it that way. There's very good reasons why students do have. There isn't any case, I think, where a student at a university or a college and so forth does not have photo ID. So we're not, you're looking at depriving people of the right to vote. So I would, I don't know if you roll
roll call has been requested, Representative Kahn. Seeing no further discussion, clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no. We are into roll call.
Anderson?
Yes.
Diskin?
Yes.
Emmer?
Yes.
Gutwall?
Yep.
Hilke?
No.
Ornstein?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Kalin?
No.
Kiffmeyer?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Marquardt?
No.
Morrow?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Moppy?
No.
Sanders?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Sterner?
Yes.
Winkler?
There being 8 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. I have a A3 amendment. A3 amendment does not.
Nope.
All right, that's it. All right, any further discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Kahn, want to renew your motion that
yes,
House File 1817 as amended, you recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
No.
Motion prevails. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1053. Representative. Representative Simon, I know there's been some discussion as to where this bill is going to go, and I think you have cleared the deck, so it's going, your motion is to do what?
The motion, Mr. Chair, would be to recommend that House File 1053 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
All right. Representative Simon, to you.
Let me amend the motion.
All right. You need the A1 amendment?
No, I need to re-amend.
Sorry.
This bill's going to finance.
All right. Why don't you withdraw the first
motion? I'll withdraw the first.
And then your motion would
motion,
be?
And the motion would be that House File 1053 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Then do you move the A1 amendment for that?
Yes, Chair.
So you're moving the A1 amendment? Representative Simon?
Yes.
All right. Why don't you explain the amendment?
Actually, if we could put it's a technical amendment.
All right. Author's amendment. So is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Simon, 2-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll describe the bill very briefly and then hand it over to Secretary Ritchie, and then Ms. Fraser can answer some of the technical questions, including the amendment that we just put on. This is the 21st Century Voter Registration Bill. And basically the idea behind this proposal is to streamline the system, to cut back on the need for individuals to fill out forms with multiple agencies with similar information, hopefully reduce data entry errors, cut back on the need for groups to do widespread voter registration drives, reduce the number of same-day registrants, and save local governments a lot of money, potentially millions, in reduced data entry and election judge costs. So basically here's what the bill does. The first thing is it does is it require an opt-out system for voter registration on applications for driver's licenses, state IDs, or instruction permits. Right now we have an opt-in system where if you go to renew your driver's license, as I just did a couple months ago, you can check a box if you want that information to be used to register or re-register you to vote. This would simply reverse the presumption that you check a box if you want to opt out of that system, otherwise you're presumptively opted in. Next, this enables the Secretary of State's office to check to see if databases indicate that the individual is ineligible to vote. A postcard is sent to voters that will notify the voters if they're now registered, if they are eligible. It also provides for automatic updates to voter registrations for those whose name changes are processed through the courts, and then it authorizes the Secretary of State's office to access a number of state databases, including Department of Corrections database regarding felons, Department of Public Safety database regarding citizenship, and a Social Security Administration database regarding recent deaths. That's what the bill does in a nutshell. I'll turn it over then to Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Secretary, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. This bill tackles two problems with a very elegant solution. The first of those problems is that we have roughly 600,000 Election Day registrations or last-minute registrations that then must be data entered and compared against all the different lists and databases that we have to verify them against. In the post-election period, there's a lot of cost to this. There's a tremendous amount of work and errors occasionally in typing, and of course months of delay. We're only now seeing the final entry of those 600,000. So that means that the list that we are working from prior to the election are 600,000 of the records are either wrong in terms of address or simply have mistakes or name changes or things that make those records not useful for politicians who are knocking on doors and making phone calls, and also very difficult for our office to use to help catch some of the potential errors in the system. So we have 600,000 people registering on Election Day or late in the process that have to be data entered. Simultaneously, we have access to very good new and somewhat expanded electronic lists. Representative Simon mentioned the data Department of Corrections list, which gives us a very complete electronic list of people under their jurisdiction. This is a huge step forward from the paper list that we've been able to receive from the courts in the past, essentially almost impossible to make use of. The Social Security list gives us access to the names of Minnesotans who died outside of the state. We have good access if somebody dies in the state, but if they're in Florida, Arizona, we must access the national list. And of course, on citizenship status, the new status check information is quite helpful. So for us, this bill will create a very complete and very accurate and electronically comprehensive pre-election database of our eligible registered voters, which we can then run against lists of people who died, people who are under correction supervision, people who are not citizens, so that going into an election, our lists are as complete and current and accurate as they can be, instead of months after the election, under the current sort of hand data entered process. And final thing is, each of the counties that we've spoken to have described very significant cost savings to them, if the data entry of duplicates, if they're hard to read and often mistakes that are made, if all those things can be eliminated through the use of more electronic processes for registration, for updating addresses, a tremendous amount of money can be saved at the local level. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Frazier, did you need to testify to the bill? You're on the list, but...
Mr. Chair, I don't need to testify to the bill. I'd be happy to answer any technical questions.
We've got one more individual that wishes to testify on the list. Mr. Relenga, do you want to come up? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Velenga. I'm president of Heartland Democracy. That's a new group, a Midwestern group, of working in Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. We do research and education, and we engage the public on civic issues. We're here today because we strongly support this bill. We think it's well-crafted, it's important, and the Secretary of State's office and Mr. Simon have done great work on this. We're also here because just a month ago, we issued our first report as a new organization. It's a report calling for a 21st voter registration system, and that's available on our website at www.heartlanddemocracy.org. What I want to say today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that if you're looking for some good government, pragmatic innovations, ways to improve governmental performance, and to reform elections in the aftermath of the 2008 election, this is a great way to do it. In our view, it's all motherhood and apple pie. There's some recent research that backs up this kind of this technical innovation. In addition to our own report, New York University's Brennan Center for Justice did a report in early 2008 calling for this kind of a system, automatic voter registration. And just last week, something called the Cooperative Congressional Election Survey, which is a consortium of 150 scholars, election scholars, produced a study led by an author at Harvard that called for these kinds of improvements in registration as well. The New York Times did a story on it on March 11th. So I don't want to repeat what the Secretary of State has already said, but quickly, in our view, the current system has high costs that don't need to be so high. It has inefficiencies. It provides inadequate service to the public, in as much as there are problems with tracking accurate voter registration. And now is a great time to do this. We have the technology to implement this system. The databases exist. And it's possible to reduce our costs, produce more accurate, clean, and complete voter rolls, even further reduce the very unlikely possibility of fraud, manage the workload for the counties, the local units of government, and the Secretary of State's office in a smoother way, and in short, improve governmental performance, reduce the lines at the polls for registration, and reduce the hassle for voters. You know, in our old conception of voter registration in America, we have thought that folks needed to jump through various hoops in order to qualify to vote. But under this forward-leaning change, we would be reducing the barriers to voting for people. We'd make it easier. If we were running a well-run private company, and the CEO decided he wanted to increase efficiencies and improve service to his clients, that CEO would undertake this kind of a reform. A couple final thoughts. Registration for voting is a good thing when people become engaged in the system. But the most important thing is to get people to the poll and allow them and encourage them to vote. When people actually understand that they're registered, they're invited into the public forum, they're able to vote, that process causes people to become stakeholders in democracy. And when folks understand that barriers have been removed and then they become stakeholders in their community, they listen to elected officials and they get involved day by day and week by week at a higher level. This has been studied, and if you folks would like us to come by and consult with you, we can furnish further studies on this. Finally, in our view, this is a question of accountability. The government is accountable for an excellent system. We ought to have high standards for our performance. Yes, folks, citizens have a right and a duty to vote. At the same time, government has a duty to provide an efficient and accurate system. So this is one small step. It's an evolutionary step. But it's an important sign of progress in our move forward towards the 21st century voter registration system, and most importantly, the health of our functioning democracy. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer, you wish to know.
I do.
Question. All right. Representative Emmer.
Thank you for coming. Good morning. You said that we have some problems tracking our voter registration. What kind of problems do we have tracking our voter registration?
Mr. Ballinger?
Well, I think from my understanding, the when people move from one place to another, as Beth Fraser was saying earlier, tracking those moves is time-consuming. As the bill says, when folks are coming off and on to voter rolls, coming into the state, coming out of one jurisdiction into another, tracking those moves is a challenge for the system. And let me quote to you from the New York Times summary of that Harvard MIT study last week. They said that the most common registration problems involve clerical errors like entering voter information incorrectly in statewide databases, or voters who change their address but fail to inform election officials. And I would defer to Beth Fraser and the Secretary of State's office, who are the experts on this question.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. You had said that this would clear up problems that we have tracking voter registrations and problems or issues with voter registration rolls. My understanding is that we are able to verify that based on what Ms. Fraser was talking about earlier. And I just have some serious concerns that you talk about the government being accountable. The citizens need to be accountable. We need to do a better job not just inviting them in, because we already invite the citizens in. We need to do a better job of getting them engaged, giving them some reason to vote. And I guess while I appreciate the testimony, I have some real concerns about taking away any need to even think about it. And it suggests that we could never have the same type of clerical errors when, for instance, you're applying for a driver's license or some other ID, and I think those errors can still be there. So maybe we look at this from a little different perspective.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually here, we're ready to move on.
Where do you need the amendment?
Let me tell you, we've been working with Mr. Gehring here, and maybe he could read it, but it would be online.
Representative, why don't we let Mr. Gehring read it, and then we can make sure that everyone understands what the technical written amendment says. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, this is a technical amendment to House File 1053 as amended, so you could see the change on the A1 amendment. On page 3, line 22 of the A1 amendment, after the word until, you'd insert, the Commissioner of Public Safety has certified that the department's systems have been tested and can accurately provide the necessary data, and the effect of this amendment is basically to prohibit a person from being automatically registered to vote until both the Department of Public Safety and the Secretary of State have certified that their systems are operable for this process.
Representative Simon, you understand the amendment. The Secretary of State's office is... Why don't we have the Secretary of State's office just confirm the amendment? Go ahead, Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This amendment was is being offered in response to concerns by the Department of Public Safety, wanted to be sure that the language is clear, that the system is not a go until their systems are in place as well as ours.
Members, does everyone understand the amendment? Mr. Gehring, then you have it in writing, and Mrs. Anderson will enter it in the record. Representative Simon will move the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion to the bill is amended. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to talk about Section 9. currently, citizens have to think and act about registration. They have to think and remind themselves that they need to be registered. They have to act, they actually have to go out and register. The same as Toronto Election Day or absentee ballot. Citizens, voters have to think about it and they have to act. What Section 9 does is that when it comes to registration, they don't have to think about it, they don't have to act. It's just automatically done for them. And, you know, switching from the opt-in to the opt-out, I think causes us to basically say citizens don't have to think, they don't have to do anything, it's done for them. And I really wonder about the advisability of that. Representative Simon, can you say more about why you think we need to do this? You know, one of the reasons I heard was the problem with Election Day registrations. I agree that we've got a problem with too many people registering on Election Day. In my community, 30% of the people registered on Election Day. That's too high. And we need strategies to get people to register sooner. And you know, I just really question if this is the way to do it, because it changes that fundamental principle that citizens have to think about it and they have to act, but they no longer have to think or act when it comes to this provision. Can you say more about that, Representative Simon?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lannan. Well, I think you nailed it in one sense, which is the need for fewer same-day registrants. And this will cut down on a lot of paperwork and a lot of extra time for not only the would-be voter, but also for those who are there on election day. The other thing, though, is that I guess I would differ with you that the voter no longer has to think or no longer has to do anything. They still have to show up somewhere, and they still have to decide where they want to vote. This just makes sure that the information which they would already presumably be given would already be there. And so I guess we just have a difference of opinion as to whether that would move us in a different direction. To me, it just makes it easier for the voter and reduces the barrier to entry for the voter.
Representative Lang, you want to continue?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think this is a fundamental change that we should not be making. I think voters should have to think about this and act to register and not have it automatically done for them. I think that's going in the wrong direction.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, I guess I have echo my colleagues' concerns. The testifier who was up previously said that we have a right and a duty to vote. And I guess it's just a fundamental disagreement. I do agree we have a right. However, I think we have a right not to vote. That's part of being a free citizen. So I don't agree with the word duty. And the opting, and maybe it's just a philosophical difference in how we go. But I do see this moving us down the road towards compulsory voting. And I guess I'll just ask Representative Simon, is that a fundamental philosophy that you have, that to be a citizen of this country, you have to vote? Is that your philosophy?
Representative Simon.
No, Representative Simmons. I think it's up to the individual voter. I don't favor compulsory voting.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gobble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I noticed throughout the bill and through the A1 amendment that we've got a lot of this "if available" language both inserted and included in the original bill, and it strikes me as there's so much of it in there that how useful is that information if we're putting it in statute if it's only given upon availability? Maybe you could speak to that.
Ms. Frazier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald. Most of the "if available" language actually has to do with information that's being transferred between departments. So from the courts to our office, from the Department of Corrections to our office, and they do not have individuals' driver's license numbers, for example, in all cases. So we don't want to require them to provide us with information that they do not have.
Representative Gallo.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Frazier or Representative Simon, how do we do a good job of verifying information as it's being transferred? If we've got if available on things like birth, address, driver's license, identification numbers, if it's not available, if people choose not to provide it, or if it's not in the database and you're trying to verify it with another one, how do you accomplish secure, accurate data matching up? How do you verify it?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I don't believe that there's any place where birth or address are only provided if available. And voters would need to provide... I don't think that that's... Is there some place in the bill where you can point me? Because I don't think...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the A1 amendment and crosswalking it, and there is a point at which you insert "and if available." And if I'm cross-checking it right, we're talking about a place where we're inserting it after birth. Date of birth, if available. Where are we here? I'm looking at the A1 amendment, line 1.17. And that is matching up with page 1, line 22. Now that's one spot. Well, you've got "and if available" inserted twice in the line 1.22 of the bill. Driver's license, identification card number, last four digits of the individual social security number, date of birth, we're over on 2.10 to 2.12. So you've got Secretary of State, the name, address, and date of birth, and then you're inserting "if available." So again, if what you're saying, Ms. Frazier, is true, that you know sometimes we don't have that information. And I'm not trying to do a gotcha here. I'm just trying to understand. We've got "if available" a lot in here, and if it's not available in one database and it is in another, or it isn't in either, how are we able to? And my concern with all of this is voter integrity. How do we make sure, as we're doing this stuff electronically, that we're matching things up accurately if we don't have that information available?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, Section 3, for example, where you're pointing out that it's added twice, we are adding that the courts, in addition to providing us with name, address, and date of birth, which they're already required to provide to us, that they provide us with these identification numbers, but only if they have them. So we're actually, by adding the identification numbers where they have them, making it much easier to make sure we're talking about the same individual.
So, but Mr. Chair, Ms. Frazier, if available, kind of neuters that whole thing, frankly. I mean, if they don't have it, it really doesn't help at all, correct?
Secretary of State. Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, in all of these issues that you're raising, the answer is we have to look at them individually, deeply. We have to call DPS or Department of Corrections. We have to go back and forth. When there is something not right, it takes attention and it takes individual attention to the record, and that's what we do day in and day out. And it's largely done at the county level when it comes to the actual registration. It's largely done in our office when it's Department of Corrections, Department of Vehicle Services, that kind of thing. It's one at a time. Representative Gallo.
No, Mr. Chair and Secretary Ritchie, what are we saving then if we're doing this kind of one by one? Things don't match up. Something's not available.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, in Hennepin County, it's $1 million to $2 million per election cycle in one county. Right, Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, you conforming with federal law, you've got stuff on citizenship in here, but I'm concerned that it doesn't... What do you require exactly to verify citizenship? And I'm looking specifically on pages 4 and 5. At the top of 5, you talk about this computerized driver's license record where you've added citizenship as a requirement. But how do you do that? If you go back to Section 8, you say you're going to have access to DPS records, but DPS records, they don't verify citizenship. They say they have a status check on them, But a lot of these departments are actually instructed not to check that sort of thing. So how do you know that, in fact, we've got a verified citizen?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to defer to
Ms. Frazier.
To the Secretary of State's office.
All right. Ms. Frazier. Secretary of State.
Ms. Chair, Representative Emmer, Department of Public Safety and Department of Vehicle Services are very serious about requiring citizenship proof in the application for a new driver's license. Of course, that will be incredibly extended when the Real ID is imposed from the federal level. But right now, those status check informations are absolutely clear and verified. And whether other agencies use them or not, I don't know. But our department uses them, and we use them a lot. And they are absolutely accurate in their citizenship information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to hear from somebody at DPS and what it is that they require. And I hope that you're wrong about Real ID, but we'll see.
All right. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, a couple times in this bill you've added the language instruction permit, like line 4.25 and 4.30. Could you expound a little bit on that, why that's included, maybe the scope of who an instruction permit goes to, or are we going to have 15 and 16-year-olds worrying about having to be scrubbed from the voter registration list?
Representative,
one of the main goals of this bill is to reduce duplicative data entry. Right now, DVS is entering all of this data, and then county auditors are entering all of the same data again, which doubles the chances of typos and other issues. So there are people who are over 18 who get instruction permits. We would not register anyone who is not eligible, so we would look at their birth date. If they were not 18, they would not be registered to vote. The bill instructs our office when people turn 18 to then check and see if they are eligible, and if they are, then register them. But the goal is to decrease duplicative work, increase efficiencies in government.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on to line 4.34, kind of want to echo what's been said a couple times. The original language there says applicants for driver's license or identification cards must be asked if they want to register to vote, and then on 5.1 at the same time. I think we have a system in place now where if the law is being followed, folks, when they're going for a license or instruction permit, identification card, they have to be asked if they want to register to vote. So I guess my question is, we already must verbally ask them if they want to register to vote. So I guess my real question is why do we need to take that choice away from them and make them then choose not to be registered when, clearly right now they can say yes or no?
Ms. Frazier or Representative Simon?
Well, Representative Sanders, I don't think that it requires a verbal ask. I think that it's referring to the form, or at least in my own experience in December, I was never asked, but there was a form that where I had to check the box if I wanted it to be forwarded for voter registration information. If someone knows differently, they can say, but I think it's referring to that form.
Ms. Frazier, you want to clarify that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, in most cases, this isn't a question of whether people want to be registered to vote or not, because over 90% of eligible voters do eventually register in Minnesota. It's a question of when they're registered and whether we have to retype in the information, whether the information comes in a crush just before election day requiring overtime and extended hours, or whether it comes in pieces throughout the year, making workflow more manageable. So in a lot of cases, it's not will these people register, it's when will they register, and will they register right before election or on election day. This would significantly decrease the crush of voter registrants in districts like Representative Lanning, and would reduce the need for groups to do voter registration drives.
Representative Sanders, and we're going to have to move on.
No, I feel like that is their right, though. And I get trying to make things easier on the system, and maybe we need to draft some other changes. But as of now, in the system, it's their right, and I think that's what Representative Lanning and Representative Distance, the point they're trying to make, and I guess I just echo that.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to follow up with Representative Emmer's questions about status and citizenship. To get a driver's license, you have to show your status. So you can do that with a birth certificate, which would show that you were born in the United States. You can do that, I think, with a passport, which you can't get unless you're a United States citizen. If you are not a citizen, then you have to show documentation as to permanent residency or other status. I know this because my wife was originally from Sweden. She went through the immigration process, presented, and had to go through, I think, every year or 2 years maybe, and reaffirm her status. When she became a citizen, then she got this just happened in February, she got a certificate of citizenship, which she could also use. But the League of Women Voters was at the swearing-in ceremony to register everybody who was there. So the only situation where it wouldn't switch automatically would be when you go from being a permanent resident to becoming a citizen. Then the driver's license change wouldn't happen automatically, but it would happen over time. But the League of Women Voters takes care of that anyway.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, does this mean your wife has never voted for you?
Representative Winkler, that would be an interesting question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, however, she hasn't voted for my opponent either.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last point with regard to Section 9. If the registration is automatic and people haven't had to think about it or act, it seems to me that come Election Day, some people might think, I'm not registered, I don't want to stand in line, and I'm just going to stay away. Or worse yet, they could come to polls and stand in line to get registered only to find out they're already registered. And what kind of confusion is that going to bring to the whole Election Day process? So I really think this section needs a whole lot more thought before we move down this road.
Representative Simon, any further comments on the bill?
No, Mr. Chair, other than I ask for member support.
All right, so you're going to renew your motion?
Right, I'll renew my motion.
I'll call 1053 as amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Finance Committee. All right, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Junkie. Representative Junkie, House File 13. I'll move that House File 13 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Junkie, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a really simple bill. In the spirit of downsizing government, which we're in today, I have a renewed interest in this. I've talked about it and had bills on in the past couple of years, actually with Senator Larson, who's no longer here in the Senate. But I think the time has come to repeal the Designer Selection Board completely. This is a group that I think is no longer needed in the state. Basically what happens, members, is every time a state project, is $2 million or more. Now you start thinking through the bonding bill and the projects, $2 million or more, any architectural firm or design firm in the state, has to go before the Designer Selection Board, a group of people who then will take testimony from them and look at them and interview them, et cetera, and then ultimately make a decision on who gets to do the project. Well, at a time when 80% of the architects in this state are out of work, and it's a crisis situation out there, to have them to continue to have to go through this process when, frankly, it's used very little anymore. I can report, for example, Department of Administration had 58 projects that they let out bids on last year, only four of them went to the designer selection board. So for the most part, we're not using the board at all. Frankly, Wisconsin next door does not have the same setup. We always like to compare ourselves to our state next door. They do not do this. And I've heard from a lot of architects around the state, and in particular my home area. What happens, members, is I don't want to make it a rural metro issue, because I think there's just as many metro architects that do not get selected for their local area projects when they have the expertise. But I know for a fact that there's architects in every one of our towns where there's been a college project or a armory project or something else, literally within a stone's throw from a qualified architectural office. And as they try and weed their way through this system, odds are they won't even be on the final list, particularly if they're from outstate Minnesota, as I found. But I think it's true in the metro too, because I think very few people actually want to go through the time and expense, the travel, and everything else to utilize this board. So Mr. Chair and members, and I've got all kinds of statistics from years on where the jobs were awarded and where the architects are from, et cetera. I won't bore you with that, other than to say, you know, I think it's time that we sunset this board on behalf of the architects who are looking for work, award the jobs like we do in any other arena that's under $2 million. In fact, I have the department administration here. Mr. Waslowski is happy to come down and talk to you if there's a concern on how the state would handle this if the board wasn't there. They are neutral on the bill, and they're confident that they can certainly take the charge of this and do a wonderful job of building our buildings. Again, if you're an architect who has expertise in whatever project that's going on, we're able to sort that out now with our departments and department administration overseeing, and I've seen no problems whatsoever that would necessitate continuation of this board.
All right. Resident Junkie, I do have the Department of Admin on the list if they wish to come down. And then I have four other individuals that also wish to testify. And if we could make the testimony to the bill, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wisboski. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. We oversee the selection of design firms for a number of the state agencies, including Human Services, Corrections, Veterans Affairs, and also here in the Capitol Complex. And as Representative Junkie was indicating, most of the selection of A&E firms, design firms, is handled at the agency level. The vast majority of the work that we do is under that $2 million threshold. It's also under, there's also a $200,000 in fee threshold. So we currently have a process in place for making not only design firm selections, but also consultant selections. We think that is an open, fair, and competitive process. We've also, in our conversations with Wisconsin, we've discussed how they do their in-house selection of design firms. Essentially what they do is they have a selection committee that is established, and it is chaired by the head of their design and construction group, and then they have bring in staff that has architectural engineering and construction expertise, and they sit on a panel that evaluates proposals for all of their larger projects. For their smaller projects, they follow a similar process that we do in putting master contracts in place.
Your position on the bill then is, what is your position on the bill, and are you speaking for the department?
Mr. Chair, members, the department administration is neutral. I would say a couple things. We are fully prepared to take over this responsibility if the board is abolished. If the board remains in place, the Department of Administration would like to see some improvement to the process.
Representative Stringer, is it to the witness? Or?
Yes. I just wondered, is there any fiscal savings by the elimination of the board? And if so, would that be?
Mr. Waslowski, can you say, would there be?
Mr. Chair, members, the board currently receives a per diem of $55 per day, plus they get their expenses reimbursed. They also get $55 per project, and that's for reading the various RFP proposals that come in. And in many cases, to be honest, I mean, there's can be anywhere from 10 to 20 proposals that come in, so there's a fair amount of work involved there. So there would be a per diem savings. Our office also provides support for the board. And I should mention that approximately 80% of the projects that go before the board are not Department of Administration projects. We have, as Representative Junkie indicated, very few of the projects are administration projects. Most are Minsky and U of M.
We have a portion to send this to finance. So this is going to finance.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Then I have the Association of General Contractors. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Strakota. I'm an architect representing AI Minnesota.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gil Fleischacher, and I'm representing the AGC of Minnesota.
Gentlemen, I don't know which of you wishes to go first, but...
Let me speak, please, if I would, may. First of all, in direct response to Representative Junkie's comments, I'd like to say a few things. First, in the spirit of government downsizing, this is an all-volunteer board. Second, over 24 projects representing millions of dollars were reviewed by the board in 2008, not four. And third, I personally have presented before the Wisconsin Designer Selection Board. It is an all-paid board centralized in Madison, Wisconsin, with paid employees doing the selection process, in stark contrast to what we're doing here in Minnesota. We've been moderately successful there. AI Minnesota and its members are overwhelmingly in support of the current system, an independent, all-volunteer board. We believe they provided a very fair selection process in an unbiased way over the years that they've been in place. We really ask the question, what is broken here? What needs to be fixed? We have heard that the bill's sponsors' constituents are concerned about their getting of awards. And with all due respect, we in this design community do not look at projects from the board is an entitlement of a citizen of Minnesota. They need to be earned under the rules and statutes set forth. There are fixed criteria for selection. They are qualifications and technical competence, ability to deal with aesthetic factors, capacity to accomplish the work, the availability of appropriate personnel, geographic proximity to the project, and awards previously made. So we want to know if someone's getting too much work. They take that into consideration. This bill will replace a successful all-volunteer board with a patchwork of state agency selection committees that will put additional work on paid state employees that, frankly, as you well know, are being asked to do a lot more for a lot less these days. The State Designer Selection Board is a success story, in our opinion, and it has ended an era of past favoritism and replaced it with a strong, unbiased system. We believe that it has served the state very well. With regard to alleged favoritism to seven county metro area firms versus outstate architectural and engineering firms, you'll hear some testimony shortly that this simply is not supported by the facts. I do want to say that despite the success of the board, there's always room for improvement. Representative Junkie did introduce a bill in 2006, which did two things, or proposed two things, and that was that the board be ended and that there be a committee appointed through the Department of Administration to come up with a new methodology. That bill failed. But we decided that it would be a good idea to form that task force anyway, so we got together with the various members of the industries represented on the board, including AI Minnesota, the American Council of Engineers, the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota, and the Minnesota State Arts Board. This committee included outstate people as well as members of that committee. And we came up with a series of recommendations, and those recommendations were presented to the board in late 2007 and to the Commissioner of Administration in 2007. Now, honestly, I can't say that we were in total agreement with everything, but I think they were favorably received, and we continue to work with the commissioner and the board on a continued improvement to that process to this day. So I guess, in conclusion, we feel that the board is really a legislative success story. It's really volunteerism at its best and is a contributor to downsizing government. Thank you.
All right. And would you just identify yourself again for the...
Oh, sure. My name is John Strakota with AIA Minnesota.
All right. And
my name is Bill Fleischacher, and I represent the AGC of Minnesota, and I also am the newest member on the State Designer Selection Board. But as far as the AGC of Minnesota goes, very much in favor of the State Designer Selection Board. We feel that it's been a very fair, equitable procedure that's been used over the years with a good assignment of projects to architects and designers who are appropriate for the work that is being done, and I think the board has served the state very well. As the newest member of the board, I think one of the things that I have witnessed is the diversity on the board, which I think staff, with all due respect to staff of the different agencies, I don't think that diversity would exist. I'm a 35-year construction industry representative. We have engineers who have been engineers for 30-some years that are represented on the board. The architects have representatives on the board, and there's two public members. So it's a very good diversity of people who... we read each and every proposal that we get, and we all have our own interests and different aspects that we look at in the interest of the state to make sure that the right firm gets the project. I went back and looked at a couple of the statistics in terms of the issue of outstate work versus metro area work, and I just went back 3 years. In 2006, 73% of the outstate projects went to outstate firms. In 2007 and 2008, both 50% of that outstate work went to outstate firms. So in summary, in the last three years, we've looked at 48 different projects, have awarded those to 35 different firms. Of those 48, a little over half, 25 have been outstate projects, awarded to 23 different firms. 15 of those were outstate firms, for an average over the three-year period of 60% of the work going to outstate firms. And this is quite a diversity of projects, some of which really do require expertise. Some of the projects were healthcare projects and higher education projects, and there are excellent outstate architects, but I think in the interest of the state, there are firms who are better equipped and more experienced in the type of work that needs to be done, and I've been very impressed with how the board works with that. In terms of the cost, we are a voluntary board. We're all volunteers. We get $55 per day that we work on the project. So that's basically 3 days per person. So that's $990. Total cost in per diem per project, and I think that's a pretty good deal for the state of Minnesota.
All right. Then we have one more individual. Yes. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Bill Breifogel. I'm the Director of Design and Construction for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Can you say that one more time, please?
Sure. Bill Breifogel.
Okay.
Good Pennsylvania Dutch name. Appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. A quick background: I've been with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities since 2002, and have had the ability to work with the State Designer Selection Board since then. Kind of echoing some of the same comments, the board is very diverse. The members bring a lot of perspectives that I think are very valuable as MinSU selects an architect for their projects. We do go to the State Design Selection Board and state it for projects more than $2 million. What that would have meant for us this past year would have been approximately 15 projects that went through the State Design Selection Board for bonding projects from the 2008 bonding bill. Equating that to MinSU, we can do the work in-house, much like admin. We have the capability and the staffing to be able to do that. It would be an impact. Roughly, we've had a chance to take a look at it over the last couple of weeks. We figured it would probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 additional people weeks to try and replicate the same service that we're getting with the State Design Selection Board. We're very comfortable that through the State Design Selection Board, we have the ability to select the best qualified firm. Obviously, we're seeing more firms in the economic times. Recently, we have 19 or 20 proposals for every project. So, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that don't get the job for that one firm that does. In essence, this morning, from MISCU's perspective, the board provides a lot of valuable help and assistance in getting us to get the most qualified firm for our project.
Then next.
Okay. I'm Dave Oxley. I'm the executive director of the American Council of Engineering Companies of Minnesota. We represent about 150 engineering firms in the state. We were actually instrumental in helping create this board back in 1974, and we've always supported it and will continue. We think it actually is a very valuable service to the state, and I think if you really do the math and compare what it would cost to you state employees compared to this volunteer board, which gets paid very, very little to do this, I think you'd find this is truly a bargain for the state. And really, pretty much everything else I want to say has already been said, so ACEC is definitely in support of continuing with the board.
Thank you. Next, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Pleased to be here. My name is William Armstrong. I am an architect with TKDA. I'm a past president of the AIE, American Institute of Architects, St. Paul chapter, and I currently am a public member of the State Designer Selection Board. And in thinking back, I think I first presented to the State Designer Selection Board about 1978. So we didn't get the job. Since then, over the years as an architect with TKDA, we've presented on a number of projects, or we presented proposals on a number of projects. We were, you know, made it to the interview stage on a number of projects, and were actually selected on a few projects through the board. So I've seen the process from both sides. I've been with a firm that's presented and interviewed and actually sometimes been successful getting projects. I've also now for the past 2 years served on the designer selection board. I've seen it from both sides. My opinion is that it always has been a very fair, unbiased process that looks to the quality of the firms and specified any outside influences in selecting designers. Even though as a proposer I wasn't always pleased with the outcome, I believe it was a very, very fair process. And again, talking about number of proposals, I think in last year the most proposals we had on one project was 22 proposals. That's from 22 different firms. From that, we would select 3 firms to be interviewed, and ultimately one firm is awarded a contract. So you're likely going to have about 21 firms that are not happy with the process, and there are going to be, but that's the nature of our business, and I think as an architect, we understand when we pursue a project with any client, there's a lot of competition, and there's a process involved in going through it. We're not always going to be selected. But hopefully the best firm is.
We're running a little tight here on time. We have
okay.
Caucuses coming up at 10 o'clock.
Just one last point I want to make. As designers and architects, we're really faced with a lot of challenges. We hear a lot about sustainability, green architecture, the energy issues. And the bottom line of all of that is we have to be designing better buildings. We have to design buildings that are more energy efficient, that are easier to maintain, that operate more effectively and operate at less cost to the state. And all this requires the best designers. And it starts with getting quality designers and starts with a quality-based selection process that is not biased and looks at the quality of the firm. So I'd urge you to continue with the designer selection board.
Representative Junkie, I'll give you the last word here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I know we could have had 2 or 3 hours of testimony with all kinds of architects coming in. Not every architect on the AIA supports keeping this board. Trust me, I've heard from lots of them, and they are members. And frankly, members, to say that you have to go before this board to prove somehow you're worthy to build a green building or anything else, we have a lot of professional architects in this state that have just frankly thrown up their hands and said it is not worth the time, the energy, the schmoozing, and everything else that it takes to get a project done here. You know, there were facts and figures thrown out. I'm just going to read one fact and figure that I did, and again, I didn't go in depth, but I feel it's proper. From 2000 to 2005, when I first looked at this, I looked at every project in the state from the board, 109 projects. Of these, 44 were in the metro area and 65 were in greater Minnesota. Of the 44 metro projects, all firms selected by the board were from the metro area. Of the 65 outstate projects, 34 metro firms were selected by the board and 31 outstate firms were selected. So, in other words, that means that over 71% of the firms awarded projects by the board were from the metro area, even though almost 60% of the projects were outstate venues. And no, zero outstate firms were awarded metro projects. You know, we can go and dig through the stats and everything else, but the fact is we have state agencies and state employees who carry this out very well. And to correct what he said, I was giving department administration figures. They had 58 projects. Department administration had, not the whole state, department admin, 58 projects. Only four of them were done by the designer selection board. They're very capable of handling the bulk of the work that comes, and they could certainly handle four more projects a year.
All right. Any members have any discussion, because we're running up against the deadline? Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, at a time when the state has voted overwhelmingly to increase our emphasis on art, culture, and heritage, I think this is the wrong direction to move.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 13 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does not prevail. The bill is defeated. Representative Poppy.
I move the minutes of Wednesday, March 18th.
Discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.